Good morning. I want to talk to you today about something that's very, very near to my heart, that I think is the center of everything for life and for finding joy in life. I hope you are reading the words on the board there. Go after a life of love as if your life depended on it, because it does. If you don't remember anything else today, I hope you remember those words and take them with you, because they are true. You know, we are created for relationship. We are created for love, to both give and receive love. Even babies will die if they are isolated and not given love. This is such a true statement, that love, go after a life of love. That's what brings all of this into our lives. These words are found in the very beginning of the 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians. You know that chapter, the 13th chapter, where it says, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am nothing. I'm nothing without love. That is such a true statement. And then it goes on after this wonderful chapter in chapter 13, the very first words of 14, go after a life of love as if your life depended on it, because it does. I can tell you that this has been my experience, that my life depends on whether or not I pursue love. There's a wonderful statement by Henry Nouwen that I absolutely believe with all of my heart. He says the joy of life comes from the ways in which we live together. The relationships, all of this, that's the joy of life, comes from the ways in which we live together. And the pain of life comes from the many ways in which we fail to do that well. I think if you stop and think about it, you will realize that this is a very true statement. It's the relationships that bring joy to life. Oh, we get a high when there are certain things that take place, but the real joy of life comes from being in relationships, of being able to give and to receive love, both God's love and the love of other people. And so I hope we recognize that when we fail to do that well, pain is the result. Relationships are so, so critical. In fact, the Bible is, from Genesis to Revelations, a book about relationships. It's about our relationship to God, our relationship to ourselves, our relationship to other people, our relationship to things, our relationship to the universe. It's all about relationships. We are created to be in relationship. And love is the key for all of that. So we need to go after a life of love. I found that to be true when we first went to Japan many years ago. It was everything was different to me. It was totally different culture, different language, different culture. Everything was different. Even when they plowed the land, the plow through the dirt the opposite way to what it does here in the States. You drive on the different side of the road. Everything was different. And I found myself sort of at sea, because initially I couldn't even communicate with anybody. Anyway, we were there, and these differences that were a part of life became very, very much sort of the orientation for my life, because I lived among differences for 6 years. And at our first home assignment, we were in a retreat. And Dr. Eugene Stirner was in that retreat as a participant, the same as we were. And one day he came back to the group. We would meditate and be in silence, and then we would come back and share with the group. One day he came back and he said, love is the atmosphere in which our differences become contributions rather than irritations. Wow! It was like touching a live wire for me. Love is the atmosphere in which our differences become contributions rather than irritations. I wrote it down in my Bible, and I took it back to Japan with me, and what a difference it made to realize that differences are part of life. It's not our differences that separate us. It's our lack of love and our willing to accept and deal with the differences and deal with them creatively. So I would like for you to remember that statement. You know that you are not like any other person on the face of the earth. I'm not like any other person on the face of the earth. We live with differences, and how we react to those differences make all the difference in the world. But it's in relationship that we discover who we are. I know who I am because of relationship with God and relationship with the people that God brings into my life. It's impossible to talk about relationships, really talk about relationships in 30 minutes. So I just want to give us a few thought starters, things that I have learned along the way that are important to me. One of the first things that I want to share with you is that every person on the face of this earth is wounded. There's not a person in this room who is not wounded in some way. Whether we acknowledge it or not, we are all wounded people, every person. Even the tiny baby is wounded in a sense because its needs are not always met just when they want them met. If the diaper is not changed just immediately, that's a kind of wound for that child as they wait. So we are all wounded human beings. But I also believe that unless we allow God to heal those wounds, we are in trouble. Richard Rohr makes a wonderful statement. He says, unless our pain is transformed, it will be transmitted. If I do not allow the pain of my life to be healed, to be transformed, then I am going to inflict pain on other people. I really do believe that we become predominantly either wounded healers or unhealed wounders. Now, this has helped me greatly in my relationships with other people because I have come to the conclusion that when people wound me, it is not as personal as I take it to be. Everybody responds based upon the woundedness that's been a part of their lives. For instance, many of you have a dog, I trust. And some of you have a dog that absolutely adores you, wouldn't hurt you for anything in this world. That dog loves you. But if that dog has a wound and you touch that wound, what happens? That dog will go, and human beings are the same way. If we touch that wound, we may be totally unaware of what the wound is, but if somehow inadvertently we touch that wound, they will go, and they will wound. So it helps me in the forgiveness process. It helps me in the relationship process, in the initiation, in being able to initiate a process whereas those wounds can be healed. It helps me to believe that the wound inflicted upon me is not personal about Anne, but it is about the wound that the person brings to the relationship. So that helps me. I just think we need to remember that every person is wounded and we need to allow God to heal those. Brennan Manning says, in every encounter with another being, we either give life or we drain life. Do you believe that? In every encounter with another human being, we either give life or we drain life. We either enhance human dignity or we diminish it. That's a statement by Brennan Manning. I've come to believe that this is so very, very true. It's astounding to think that, as Peggy Milken says, I never touch another human being so lightly but what I leave an imprint. Wow. What if we were conscious of that? I never touch another human being so lightly that I don't leave an imprint. So what kind of imprint do I leave? What do I do with that? Well, there are so many things to say about that whole area, but there's another thing that I want to remind us of, and that is you cannot be efficient in relationships. You can be effective, but you can't be efficient. We live in a culture where efficiency is extremely important. We're constantly trying to figure out ways how to do things faster, how to do them more efficiently. We make a god out of efficiency. And we give very little thought to effectiveness. Sometimes efficiency is very damaging. particularly in relationships, when I am trying to be efficient and do this, 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 and this, it's a neat little formula, and this is what I will get. I can do a lot of damage in that. But I can be effective. So we need to remember that it's not about being efficient. It's about being effective. You see, relationships are fluid. They're messy. They're ever-changing. They're ever-becoming. Relationships do not stand still. We either are growing in the richness of the relationship, or we are regressing and finding more and more distance in the relationship. Relationships never just stand still. They're always fluid. They're messy at times. They're always changing and becoming. Another thing that I am very, very keen about is that I have to remember I cannot change anybody. Have you ever tried to change anybody? Somebody, your husband, your children, your friend? How did it work? I think from experience, we all know that you can't change anybody. And in fact, when we are focused on trying to change the other person, they dig their heels in. I do. Maybe you do too. Dig your heels in, you become more of what you are or were. It's not about changing the other person. I really believe that in relationships, we are called to create an atmosphere in which change can happen. And that is an atmosphere of love. I remember quite some years ago, I was speaking at a women's group in Virginia, and this woman came up to me after the service was over, and she looked up into my face. She was so excited. She said, "I just can't believe you can even learn something new in your 70s. Well, of course you can. I mean, that's a given. In your 90s, you can learn something new. I'm learning something new every day. I've learned something since I've been here today. You were always learning something. Anyway, she was really excited because she'd learned something new, and I was curious to know what it was she'd learned. And she started talking about her son who lived on the West Coast. And she said, "My son is an alcoholic, and I call him frequently, and I say, 'Son, you've got to stop that drinking. You've got to get that chip off your shoulder.'" She was constantly telling him, "You got to this, you got to that, you got to the other." And she said, "I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to call him, and I'm going to say, 'Son, I love you. And if you never stop drinking, I'm going to love you anyway.'" She said, "He'll probably faint." She had just been so concerned and so eager to see him change that she was trying to change him. I'm constantly amazed how we as followers of Jesus Christ pray so earnestly for somebody who desperately needs to change. And we get up from our prayer and we promptly try to change him. Maybe you're not guilty. But I have to admit, there have been times in my life when I've succumbed to that and when I've done that. I can't change anybody. What I am called to do is create an atmosphere in which God can work, in which God can do the changing that needs to happen. And another thing that what started me thinking about that woman was a statement that a woman made in a class that I'm a part of recently. She said, "Unsolicited advice is always seen as criticism." Do you agree with that? Can you identify with that? Unsolicited advice is always seen as criticism. I thought, wow, that's a profound statement. And so I thought about this woman in Virginia. When we are so concerned, sometimes we get so concerned and we want so desperately to do something that's going to make a difference. We do all the wrong things and we make matters worse rather than helping to bring the healing. So that's one of the things that I am really keen about, is that we can't change anybody. And I think we get so caught up in deciding who's to blame. When a relationship is strained, or when a relationship is broken, or when it's not as healthy as it should be, and I happen to believe you don't have to be sick to get better. I don't care how good you are, you don't have to be sick to. There's always this newness, there's always this depth, there's always this richness that we need to be reaching out for. Anyway, we get really hung up on who's to blame. I'm going to share with you a personal experience where the relationship was not broken, but it was certainly strained and certainly far beneath what I longed for it to be. I'm the youngest of five children. I am the baby. I was always the baby. As long as I had siblings, they always introduced me as their baby sister. So even in your 60s or 70s, you can still be the baby. Anyway, my oldest brother was in the Navy during World War II and formed some opinions as a part of that. And when Nathan and I were going to be going to Japan as missionaries, he had a little difficulty with that. Why were we going to those Japanese? Only that was not the word he used. Anyway, this was very difficult for him. But not only that, my brother was also an alcoholic, and his wife was also an alcoholic. And so I'd grown up in a loving home where we were all very, very close, and somehow through the years, and of course we were away, somehow through the years, the relationship had become different because his lifestyle and my lifestyle were so very different. We'd come home on home assignment, and he had a business in Bessemer, Alabama on 19th Street, and when we would come home on home assignment, we would always stop at his business, and we would go out and have a meal together. We'd go out and get a cup of coffee and a piece of pie. But he never, never invited us into his home. He never reached out. He never did any of these things. And so I would say to Nathan, well, if he wanted us to come, he would invite us. I said a lot of things. I, you know, saw him as the problem, not me as the problem. It's pretty easy to do in all relationships. We're always wanting. It's easy to look and see how the other person is to blame, but to look and see how we fit into that picture and how we are to blame for the, and it's always a two-sided thing. Anyway, one time we were coming back to the States for home assignment, and I said to Nathan before we left Japan, whatever else I do, this time I've got to connect with my brother. I've got to find a way to connect with Virgil. Well, we came home, we stopped, we went out, had a cup of coffee and a piece of pie, had a visit. He did not invite us into his home. He did not invite us. Well, it was the same old story. Same old story. So I prayed about this and I thought about it and I thought, I'm going to take a risk. So I picked up the telephone and I called him and I said, guess what? We're coming to spend the weekend with you. What could he say? I mean, I just said it. We're coming to spend the weekend with you. And so we went to spend the weekend with him. We had a weekend. I didn't know it was very difficult for them. They refrained from drinking for the weekend. They even went to church with us. It was a good weekend, really, but still not that thing that I was longing for. When the weekend was over, we were getting ready to leave. I went up to my brother. I took his face between my hands so that he could not move, and I looked him straight in the eye and said to him, I love you so much. He could not respond. We left. A couple of days later, my mother called me. She said, Virgil called me last night. He talked for about 15 minutes. And the only thing he said was, he kept saying over and over again, Mama, did you know Ann loves me? I'm the follower of Jesus. He has a totally different lifestyle, but I had never really communicated to him in a way that he understood that I loved him. I was always focused on, why doesn't he invite us into his home? Why doesn't he make us feel welcome? Some incredible things happened during that year. One of the things happened is that the two of them were out drinking rather heavily one evening. She became sick in the night and vomited and ingested that and died. And because I took that risk and because I placed my hands on either side of his face and looked him straight in the eye and somehow was able to communicate that I really meant it. I love you so much. The first person he called when he found her dead was me. Relationships are interesting. It's not who's to blame. The issue is that relationships are strained, or they are broken, or they're less healthy than they need to be. And we as followers of Jesus Christ need to find ways to help to participate with God in bringing healing to those. Another thing that I deal with in life, have dealt with in life all of my life and still deal with, is keeping God as top priority in my life. I think we fail to realize, or at least I do, all of this is for me. I talk to myself. I think it's easy for us to allow something to become so important in our lives that it somehow crowds out space for God and keeping him as top priority in our lives. We can do that with our careers. We can do it with people. We can do it with things. We can do it in a whole host of ways. Anything that you absolutely are convinced you cannot live without, unless it's God, is taking a place that it does not deserve and must not have. God has to be the center of that. I've shared this recently, and I'm going to share it again this morning. We had been married 6 years when this took place. We'd been in Japan for 5 years. When we went to Japan, we stayed 6 years without returning, and there were no emails or telephones. We were just there for 6 years, and we were out of contact with our families and all that we'd known except through letter, which took a month if they answered the day they got the letter. Anyway, Nathan and I had bonded very, very strongly. We didn't speak the language when we went. And we formed this incredible, it was the best thing that ever happened to us, to be honest. It was the best thing that ever happened to our marriage, is that we were there for 6 years, had only been married a year, and we bonded in this incredible way. Well, at the end of 5 years in Japan, we were going to be moving for the sixth year to the southern island. And so we went to the government to get permission to move. And when we did, there was something that we had not done, some paperwork, which we were unaware of. And so they said, well, one of you can go ahead and move, but the other one has to stay behind and write letters of apology and go around to the different offices in Tokyo and make your apologies. So it was decided that Nathan would go and I would stay and do the letters and do the apologies. He left in January. It was a 700-mile trip to where we were moving, and it was it took him 5 days, driving 12, 14 hours a day to get there because of the roads, because of the, the difficulty of the trip. And it was in January when we moved. He took a young Japanese man with him so that they could find the way. And they went on this trip, this 700-mile trip, this five-day trip on roads that were less than desirable. In the mountains, Japan is a very mountainous country, in the mountains with snow and ice and no guardrails. Well, as soon as they left, I lost it. I really lost it. I learned something about me that I was totally unaware of up until that point. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I was in misery. I had all these visions of the car going off the side of the mountain, Tanaka-san and Nathan both being killed. I just had all these visions. I was a basket case. There's no other way to explain it. I was a basket case. And so God began to deal with me, and I began to look inside of myself, and I began to look at my relationship to Nathan, and this is the love of my life. We had so bonded in this 6 years of marriage. But I began to realize that I was putting Nathan in a place that only God could hold. I was beginning to clutch him. I was beginning to think he was my reason for being. He was my reason for living. I would never tell anybody else they had to do the same thing, but I will tell you what I felt God said to me that I had to do. I had to pray until I could say from my heart, God, if something happens, please spare the one who can do the most for Japan. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. I was clutching this incredible, wonderful relationship that I had allowed to take the place that only God could hold. I can tell you that when I took that 24-hour train trip and I arrived in Kyushu, where we were living for the rest of our time in Japan, our relationship took on a whole new depth and beauty. And I'd like to tell you, I was never tempted again to clutch. When we clutch, we lose. We can clutch anything under the sun. We can clutch our jobs. We can feel that my reason for being is what I do. My reason for being is that I'm created in God's image and I am His child, and He has created me for relationships and for healthy relationships. Anyway, and this may sound silly to you, but you can even clutch things. The women of the Church of God provided for us, had shipped to us, an automatic washing machine, which I'd never had one in my entire life. I grew up, you know, in the 90s, you know, you grew up a long time ago. I grew up where you use the old rub board and you boil the clothes out in the backyard under this big old wash pot. Anyway, I never had an automatic washing machine, and I was sitting at my breakfast table in Futsukaichi, Japan, and I heard that washing machine doing my laundry while I was having my breakfast, and I popped out in goosebumps all over. I was so excited over that washing machine, and that washing machine began to mean so much to me, I thought I couldn't live without it. I realized that, and I said to Nathan, you need to pray for me. I need to be at a place where I could walk out this day, walk through the doors of my home, and go someplace else and leave that washing machine here, but right now I don't feel like I could. You know, it's ridiculous. It's silly. But we so easily clutch. We clutch life. We clutch people. We clutch things. We clutch activities. And we lose when we do that. Well, like I said, I can't talk about relationships in 30 minutes. But anyway, God has to be the top priority in our lives. And being real is not easy, friends. But if there's one thing we need to know, we need to learn how to be real. Oh, we live in a nation that so teaches us to play games. We play games. You know, even our response most of the time, we can be dying a thousand deaths inside, and somebody says, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. I'm great. Not great at all. We play the games. Being real is not an easy thing to do. And it's not something you learn how to do in one situation and it works in every situation. You have to learn how to be real in every situation. And you have to learn how to be vulnerable. Being real, in order to be real, you've got to be vulnerable. And you know Brené Brown's definition of vulnerability. It's the willingness to show up and be seen with no guarantee of the outcome. You may not see the connection in this, but Nathan and I worked all those years we were married on being real with each other. And then we faced the journey of cancer. We had 16 and a half year journey with cancer. And over and over and over again, I had to learn how to be real in that. I had to learn how to be real in what I was feeling and what I was experiencing. I remember a time when Nathan was unable to, we didn't yet have a hospital bed, and he was just sitting in a recliner all the time. And I'd had a kind of a rough day, and I did dinner, and we had the evening together, and I knelt down beside the recliner where he was sitting because we couldn't get him into the bed. And I had prayer with him, turned out the lights, crawled into bed. The tears were silently rolling down my cheeks. I was not making a sound. And Nathan said to me, are you okay? What do you think I said? Sure, I'm fine. A little bit, he said, are you crying? Well, I didn't consider the first one a lie, but if I said I wasn't crying, I would consider that a lie. So I said, yeah, I'm crying. He said, I'd give anything in the world to hold you. I got up out of bed and I laid my pillow on his chest, reached down, put his arms across my shoulders, and I sobbed like a baby. And he cried with me and said, "Aren't tears wonderful? They're part of the healing process." If I had not been real in that moment, if I had not been honest in that moment, I would have missed one of my greatest experiences and one of my fondest memories. I crawled back into bed and I slept like I was drugged. Had I not been real, I would have cried the rest of the night. And what I came to understand was that it was so wonderful for both of us for me to be real, because Nathan needed to comfort me as much as I needed to be comforted. He needed to comfort me. I needed to be comforted. To not be real would have robbed both of us of an experience that was so very, very precious to us. And it happened. But you don't learn it and then you have it live. You have it learned for in every situation. And the cancer journey taught me so much about that. Like the first time his bones in his back had collapsed. And so he was about 6 inches shorter than he was originally. And his body changed drastically. And the first time after he finally was able to get on a walker and I was able to get him into the shower, I was drying him off. And this was the first time he knew how much he'd changed. And he looked in the mirror and he saw himself and he said, "Oh my, how my body has changed." I wanted him to feel good. I wanted to be helpful to him. So what do I think? My first inclination is to say, "Oh, it hasn't changed that much." Thank God our eyes locked in the mirror. And I looked into those eyes and I said, "Yes, it has. But you need to know it's still beautiful because it houses the person I love." And it was never a problem. He didn't have to convince me that it had changed a lot. I didn't have to convince him, "Oh, it hasn't changed that much." We play the games. Be real. Oh, well, my time is running out, but there's one other thing that I feel is very important that I want to share with you, and that is that if we are going to have good relationships, we are going to have to learn how to listen. Listening is so, so critical. It is so critical. And listening involves being present. Totally present. How many times are you with a person who is totally present? It's amazing. It's amazing how often we are not present. You know, you can be, your body can be one place and you can be another, and you can hear the words and you can make responses and never really show up. I know that to be true. You know, I thought I had learned the importance of being present. I had both a brother and a sister who died with Alzheimer's. I don't know how many of you are dealing with people who have Alzheimer's, but the one gift you can give to them is to be totally present. They can't enter your world. You have to enter their world. And a lot of people have great difficulty with this. They feel like they're lying or whatever. Like one of either my brother or my sister, one or the other would say to me, "How is mother?" Well, mother had died years ago. But I'd just say, "Oh, I can promise you she's better off than she's ever been before." Or my sister would say, "Mother came by and stopped by today and visited." And I didn't try to convince her that, well, I certainly didn't say mother was dead, because for her it would be just happening. So I would say, "Oh, that's wonderful. What did you talk about?" And we carry on this conversation. Or, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. But to be totally present with that person is extremely important. And I thought I had learned that. One day, I finally had to put my sister, she had lived with us for years, I finally had to put her in an Alzheimer's unit in a nursing home. And one day, I was going to, well, every day I spent a couple of hours with her, and one day I had an important engagement, what I thought was very important, after I left there. And so I spent 2 hours with her, and I could push the numbers on the door to get out, but she was still able to walk and talk and quite strong, and she was holding on to me and would not let me go. So I sat down there and right inside the door, and I said, "Jerry, I don't know what else to do for you. I do the best I know how to do, blah, 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 blah." She looked straight at me and says, "Does Ann know about this?" Well, it was still all about me, and I said, Jerry, I am Anne. She looked me straight in the eye, and she said, no, you're not. Anne wouldn't treat me like this. I felt like I'd been stabbed. When I got out to my car, I put my head over on the steering wheel, and I said, God, what really happened back there? What really happened? And what I came to understand was that she couldn't let me leave because I hadn't been there. It had all been about the appointment that I had after I was to leave her. I had not shown up. So every year I choose a theme for my life. And so that year when January rolled around, I remembered that experience. And the theme for the year was to show up where my body is. A part of listening is to show up where your body is. To really hear. Not be thinking about how you're going to respond. Not trying to give an answer, not trying to fix it, not trying to listen. Augsburger says, to feel heard is so close to feeling love that the average person cannot tell the difference. If you're going to have good relationships, if you're going to have healthy relationships, if you're going to have deep, meaningful relationships, you must learn how to listen. Not to give an answer, just to help the person feel heard. It's a very, very important situation, and to be a present. And I believe that to be present is to give value to the other person, to help them understand. There is a wonderful statement, and I can't recall the name of the woman who made it, but she says that whatever lowers self-esteem increases violence. And goodness knows in our culture we need to learn the truth of that statement, because we excel in lowering self-esteem and we are increasing the violence all the time. It increases hostility. It's the phrase, I'm sorry. Whatever lowers self-esteem increases hostility. I say that we are so good at lowering self-esteem that we often increase hostility, which, when it continues, increases violence. To be present is saying to the other person, I value you, I want to hear what you say. I recognize that there are times when you do not have the ability at that moment to really listen. Then in all honesty, we need to say, you know, I can't listen right now, but I want to hear what you have to say. I will try and then set a time when you're going to listen. But listening is so, so, so important. Love is the atmosphere in which our differences become contributions rather than irritations. But do not fail to be present, because when you do not do the person the honor of being present, you are lowering their self-esteem. And when you lower their self-esteem, you are creating something that is going to get in the way of relationships. Well, go after a life of love as if your life depended on it, because it does. There's no way we can really mine all of the richness of relationships. But we are created to be in deep, wonderful, life-giving, joyful relationships that make the journey something that is absolutely incredible. I want to leave you with two questions. Is there anything or anyone that I'm clutching, that I am giving priority to above my relationship to God? The second one is, am I primarily a wounded healer or an unhealed wounder? No one is perfectly one or the other, but we become primarily one or the other. This week, will you allow yourself to think about these two questions and be real honest? Pray with me, please. God, you've created us to be in relationship. And what joy it brings to us when we do that well. We bounce with joy. We just feel so wonderful when relationships are healthy and growing and evolving and deepening. And yet, in those times when relationships are broken or strained or we become distanced from the people we love, it creates such pain inside of us. God, help us to be in such a relationship with you that you can come and touch those places that need to be healed, that free us up. You can come and help us to be vulnerable and transparent and real and honest in the relationships, which gives the opportunity for you to bring about change in us. But it also makes it possible for us to create an atmosphere in which we can bring about change in the people we care so deeply about. God, touch us where we need to be touched. You know us better than we know ourselves. God, we've all been wounded in some way. Will you come and visit each one of us individually in this moment and touch us where you see and know we most need to be touched? Free us up. Free us, we pray, to be in relationships that not only benefit us, but benefit every person whose lives we touch. We long to be wounded healers. We long to be aware that we never touch another person so lightly but what we leave an imprint. God, let that imprint be one of love. Let that imprint be one of forgiveness. Let it be one of grace. God, it's all about grace. Make us children of grace, we pray. Children of relationships that honor you and bring joy to our world. We pray in the name of Christ. Amen.